thanks to the Breakfast team, it's now time for discovery, and this week we're going to take you on a tour of the universe.
Welcome.
Stand and welcome.
Hello, good evening and welcome
to Discovery.
Discovery.
Listen to Discovery.
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 Sounds like a lot of fun.
Somewhere in space, this may all be happening right now.
Now, to the speeded up brain of the user, that sound lasts for 4 hours and sounds like this.
Discovery. Yeah.
Welcome to Discovery, your 30-minute guide to the world of science. I'm Noel Hannah, and this week we're going to hear about the dark side of the universe and gamma ray bursts.
This is the Discovery News, and I'm Adam Richardson. You might know your blood type, but do you know your pooch's? According to ABC Science Online, for the first time, the blood type of your best friend can be accurately determined from the 8 different canine blood types. This is important because dogs, who have at least double the amount of main blood groups that humans have, can only receive one transfusion from an incompatible blood group. If they receive more than one transfusion, their immune system will trigger a response against proteins found on the surface of the foreign red blood cells. This immune response can actually kill the dog. Dr. Kate Swen-Wen Chang from the University of Melbourne developed the blood typing technique. It uses genetically engineered antibodies that recognize the different cell surface proteins unique to cells of different blood types. These engineered antibodies don't attack the cells like dogs' natural antibodies do. This new technique is hoped to be more reliable than the current technique of mixing the patient's blood with the blood to be used from the transfusion and waiting to see if there is a reaction. Move over wrinkles. Your teeth may be the key to revealing how old you are. Researchers from Karolinska Institute in Stockholm have found that levels of carbon-14 found in tooth enamel can estimate age. Carbon-14 is a radioactive isotope that was released into the environment after the testing of nuclear weapons during the Cold War. Once released, it was absorbed by many different crops, and now after consuming these crops, carbon-14 is traceable in our tooth enamel. The levels of carbon-14 in our atmosphere decline over time, which results in a decline in the amount being consumed, and the levels in our teeth decrease accordingly. However, after a certain age, the body does not replenish tooth enamel, so level of carbon-14 becomes fixed, and researchers can match these levels with the atmospheric levels of different years, like a nuclear fingerprint. This technique, which can predict a person's age within 1.5 years, has already been used to identify 6 tsunami victims from last year. If going home to meet your girlfriend's mother seemed a bit daunting, count your blessings that you're not a bat. Stephen Rossiter from Queen Mary University in London studied a group of bats living in a mansion attic and noticed that the rate of partner swapping between related female bats was a lot higher than expected. It is believed that sharing males between the female line encourages close families who can cooperate with each other. Rossiter and his team monitored the community of bats in the attic for over 10 years. They identified the parentage of bats by catching the mothers during suckling and studying both highly variable and repeated sequences of DNA in the offspring, much like paternity testing in humans to determine the father. Although these families are close-knit, the bats managed to avoid inbreeding, and Rossiter's studies of mating habits of 45 females found only one case of a daughter mating with her father. How they avoid mating with such close family members is still a mystery, but Rossiter's next study is to see if their sense of smell plays any part.
Okay, now Matt is going to tell us about the 96% of our universe that until now remains in the dark.
Well, Douglas Adams once wrote in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, "Space is big. You just won't believe how vastly, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you might think it's a long way down to the road to the shops, but that's just peanuts to space. Now, this is a nice quote, but this is true. Space is vast and huge, and it does make us sometimes feel a little bit tiny and insignificant, sitting out on our little rock at the edge of the universe. But what we've discovered in recent years is that not only is space really big, but it's filled mainly with stuff that's completely different to the ordinary matter that you or I are made of. So not only are we really small, but we're made of stuff that only makes up a very small part of the universe. So this stuff that we're made up of, this is the stuff, basically all the chemicals that is around us, everything that's in the famous periodic table in chemistry, plus a few extra bits that have been discovered by particle physicists by smashing things together. But all of this stuff is what you or I are made of, what the stars, planets, comets, asteroids, meteorites, anything like that, all the things we see in the sky are made up of this kind of normal stuff. And all of these elements, they still only make up about 4% of the total amount of energy or stuff in the universe. So how do we get to the startling position where we think the stuff we're made of is such an insignificant part of the universe? What is the other 96% of the universe? To answer this, we need to go over to the dark side, to the vast, invisible sea of energy that makes up most of the universe. Now, the dark side of the universe is actually made up of two parts, dark matter and dark energy. I'm going to tell you about dark matter. Now, dark energy is even weirder still, but dark matter is still pretty strange. Now, we call it dark matter because it's dark. We can't see it. It doesn't give off light, and it doesn't absorb light either. It doesn't interact with light in any way, so we call it dark. But we call it matter because it works with gravity in the same way as the regular matter that you and I are made of, the stars and the planets are all made of. Works with gravity in the same way. So if you replace the sun, big lump of burning gas, if you replace it with a big lump of dark matter that was the same mass, the planets would keep happily orbiting around it just as if it was the sun. It interacts with gravity in the same way. But of course, we would become very dark and cold without the light from the sun. Now this, the first piece of evidence we have for dark matter existing at all, we find by looking at how galaxies spin around. Now, you've probably seen at some stage a photo of a nice, pretty spiral galaxy. The ones that look like they're spinning around like a firecracker. Now, indeed, galaxies are spinning around. They're spinning very slowly. They take millions of years to make a single spin, but they are indeed spinning. Now, we have to imagine things spinning and try and work out what's going to happen. Now, imagine you're sitting at the edge of, say, a merry-go-round that's spinning around and around. Now, as it gets faster and faster, if you want to not fall off, you have to hold onto that merry-go-round tighter and tighter. So what we say is you're exerting a force on that merry-go-round from your hands, and the faster it's going, the stronger that force needs to be. And if you let go, you'll suddenly fly off and travel in a straight line from wherever you're holding. You last were attached to the merry-go-round. Now, the same thing happens when stars spin around galaxies. But now, instead of having a merry-go-round providing some sort of mechanical force, we have the force of gravity. So the stars, if gravity suddenly stopped working, would fly off in a straight line. But because gravity is sucking the stars in towards the middle of the galaxy, it makes them spin around in a circle. But what we do with what we know about gravity, we add up all the stars and all the things we can see in a galaxy, and we find that all the stuff there doesn't provide enough gravity to allow the stars to spin around like they do. So it's like you're watching a really big fat guy on a merry-go-round that's made of tissue paper. So you think that tissue paper shouldn't be able to hold this guy spinning around as fast as he is. So we look at it, but we know it can't be the case. And this is the same thing as when we look at galaxies. Now, to explain this, we need a much stronger force of gravity. And it turns out we need about 10 times as much dark matter to be in the galaxies as the normal matter. So with all this extra dark matter adding to the force of gravity, we can make the breakneck speed that galaxies seem to spin around with make sense. Now, this is only the first piece of evidence for dark matter, and others since have been found, such as a similar situation when you have groups of galaxies are falling in towards each other, but the speed that they're doing it is way too fast for the matter that appears to be there. So again, we need roughly 10 times as much dark matter as ordinary, the normal matter. Now, there have also been suggestions that there might be lots of dark galaxies in the universe that are made entirely of dark matter. Now, of course, it would be very difficult to ever find out if these things did actually exist because we simply can't see the stuff. But it is a nice idea that maybe out there are many more galaxies than we can see, but they're just completely made of this strange dark matter. We don't really know what dark matter is made of. All we know it's something that's got to be completely different to all the things we've ever observed in labs on Earth. But two possible explanations have been thought up, and they're both of the very strange names. One is called WIMPS, which stands for Weakly Interacting Massive Particles, but really is just a very strangely contrived acronym to make a really cool name of WIMPS. And the other possibility is that of MACHOS, which stands for Massive Compact Halo Objects. But again, it doesn't matter what it stands for. It was just contrived, so we have this nice name of WIMPS and MACHOS. But really, it's all just trying to hide the fact that, to be honest, we don't have a clue what this stuff is.
Okay, that was Matt there telling you about the WIMPS and MACHOS of the universe. You're listening to Discovery here. Okay, the music you were listening to there was Tinaro N with The Traveller in the Desert. Now, Chris Stewart is going to tell you why astronomers are frothing at the mouth over something that happened a very long time ago.
Well, we heard a little while ago about how big the universe is. It's a very, very big place, but it's not just big, it's really old as well. And it's not very often that astronomers get a chance to glimpse exactly how old the universe is. So something happened very recently which got a whole pile of astronomers around the world really, really excited about something which lasted an incredibly short period of time and yet allowed them to glimpse further back into the history of the universe than pretty much anyone's ever seen before. Now, what was it that these guys managed to see? It was a thing called a gamma ray burst. And it lasted for all of, a couple of hours. It kind of sort of hung around with a bit of an afterglow for a couple of days after
that. Isn't that what turned Peter Parker into Spider-Man?
I think it was. No, he was...
Or was that the Hulk?
I think it was the Hulk.
Maybe
thinking
the Hulk.
Of there. No one got...
There's no risk of that, is there?
No one got turned into a superhero on this one. So let me just explain briefly what a gamma ray burst is. Gamma ray burst is a burst of gamma rays. Duh, thank you for that. Gamma rays, very high energy particles, very high energy photons. And what we're talking about here is when a very large star reaches the end of its life, it tends to go bye-bye in a very big way, big explosions. Part of this, in the various scenarios for the way a star can end its life, but one of the ways it can do it is by sort of collapsing down, and in doing so it sends out beams of high-energy particles and light, sort of in opposite direction, kind of like a lighthouse. And these beams will sort of shine out across the universe. And if you happen to be in the path of one of these things, then what you'll see is just in a spot of the sky that you might not have noticed anything terribly bright before, suddenly something incredibly bright shows up. And then a little while later, it disappears again. It's a burst. It's a gamma ray burst. Now, if you see one of these things, you'll know it as an astronomer. You're looking up in the sky. It's dark. It's dark. It's dark. Oh, it's very bright. Oh, no, it's gone again. It's very dark. That must have been a gamma ray burst. Trouble with your average gamma ray burst is, as I mentioned before, they don't last very long. So in the past, if you managed to see a gamma ray burst, you were very, very lucky. It really was. It's kind of like seeing a shooting star. You know, there it is. Where? Over there. No, it's gone. You missed it. You know, if you didn't happen to be looking in the right place at the right time, it's gone.
It must have been very hard to record those types of things in the past.
Well, it was, and I think it's something which has only really been seen fairly recently. Part of the reason for that is that a hell of a lot of the energy that's coming out of these things isn't visible light. You know, the amount of visible light you get out of it is not nearly as much as you get in the much higher energy wavelengths. But the other reason is, of course, that did I see that? I don't know. It's gone now. It's too late to go and check. So when astronomers managed to get a little bit of technology on their side, what they were able to do was put up a satellite into orbit. And this very clever satellite called the Swift Gamma Ray Burst Mission, put up by NASA, all it does is wander around the Earth looking up at the night sky. And when it sees something that looks like it might be a gamma ray burst, very bright flash, it quickly jumps on its inbuilt computer and emails all of the astronomers all over the world and says, quick, 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 look, up here, at this particular coordinates in the night sky. And all the astronomers go, oh, bloody hell, and turn their telescopes around and point in the right direction in the sky, and everyone quickly records. Because we are talking something which can be over in a matter of a couple of hours. Then there is a bit of an afterglow which can go on for a few days. But if you really want to capture the event, you haven't got a lot of time. Which is why astronomers tend to just sort of, you know, not really get out terribly much. Your average astronomer is just kind of hanging around, waiting for stuff like that, waiting to be emailed by a satellite, basically. So why is it that these guys have gotten particularly excited by this flash in the night sky? Well, back on 4th of September, this Swift satellite, the gamma ray satellite, sent down an email saying, oh, look, up here in this particular part of the night sky. And they all turned and they had a look at it. And when they sat down and did the calculations and they figured out all the energy that's coming from this thing and they did the calculations of how far away this thing is, they found that it was a very, very long way away indeed. And they did some other calculations and they realized that it's not just a very long way away, it's very, very old. Because, of course, what you have to realize is that when you're looking out into the night sky, you're actually looking back in time as well. The light that's reaching us from a very long way away took a very long time to get to us. What they found was that this particular gamma ray burst must have originated when the universe was only about 900 million years old. Now, to anyone who doesn't really talk about cosmological timescales, that's pretty old. But when you think about the fact that, as far as we can determine from most of the measurements, the universe is about 13.5 billion years old, then we're going back in time to when the universe was almost 13 billion years ago. This is a really, really long time ago. This is one of the oldest things we've ever, ever seen.
Just a toddler.
Just a toddler. So all of these astronomers are looking at this thing going, this is the oldest thing that we've been ever able to see. This is incredible. And it's gone. Bugger. Did you record that? I hope someone recorded that, because that was really exciting. And of course, one of the reasons why we want to see these very, very old things is because way back 13 billion years ago, the universe was a very, very different place. And what the astronomers think is that this particular gamma ray burst came from a death of a star before there were even galaxies. So this is one of the first stars that was ever created in the universe, one of the first stars ever to die, and they recorded it on film. So that's why astronomers are frothing at the mouth over this particular one. They're a funny bunch. But that's astronomy for you.
Thanks, Chris. What I actually found interesting about that story is that NASA has put a satellite into space for the purpose of sending spam to people. Well, there you go.
60 Second Science.
Army doctors praise the effectiveness of a new super bandage that is currently only available to soldiers. What's the secret behind these bandages? The answer is prawns. John Holcomb, who is a surgeon for the US Army in Somalia, has been working on the new kinds of bandages to try to decrease the amount of blood loss on the battlefield. He has produced bandages which are laced with a mixture of ground prawns and vinegar, which clot the blood immediately. The secret ingredient in the prawn shells is called chitosan. Unlike the gauze that traditional bandages are made from, chitosan interacts with our blood because its molecules carry a positive electric charge. The outer membranes of our red blood cells all carry negative charges. These negative charges are attracted to the positive charge of the chitosan. As soon as they touch, the red cell fuses and forms a clot against the chitosan. This forms a very tight seal against the surface of the wound. These bandages are currently being used in Iraq, and reports say that they have saved many potential casualties.
60 seconds. Silence.
Adam McCurdy from Masada College. 60 Second Science is brought to you by high school students enrolled in the University of Sydney's course Problem Solving and Communication in Science.
Romero. Lion.
You're listening to Discovery, and finally we have another story about wind power. Chris.
Yeah, this is the story about how to make something which is already good even better. Look, if I were to ask the Discovery team that's in here tonight, what are the main problems that we've got with generating electricity at the moment? What's our main source of electrical power
at the moment? In Australia, it's coal.
It's dirty, most of it's from coal. These are fossil fuels. Nobody likes fossil fuels. They're bad. They're evil. So what are the other possibilities?
Unless you're an oil company.
Yes, well indeed. So what's the other main way that we get electricity in the world if it's not from coal? What's the next biggest one? Nuclear. What's the problem with nuclear? Big barrels of stuff. You've got to bury them somewhere. No one wants them. What if they go into meltdown and sort of burn through the center of the earth? And nuclear, we're a bit hazy about. Not a good thing to put in any people's minds. So what's another good one?
What about solar? We've got plenty of sun in Australia.
Plenty of sun. Any problems with solar?
Inefficient.
Inefficient, not quite there yet. So one of the big ones that's been put up on, you know, in people's fields and paddocks and backyards all over the world, getting stronger and stronger, is wind power. Bloody great windmills being put up and huge turbines churning around whenever the wind blows, creating electricity. It's a great idea, except if you've got one of these in your backyard, because they're huge buggers. Enormous things. They make a lot of noise, and apparently they reduce your TV reception. And if there's anything that's going to really tick off the neighbours near your wind power farm, it's going to be that they can't get neighbours anymore. So one of the ideas that's come out recently about how to do wind power better is to not have them on the ground anymore. There's an engineer here at the University of Technology in Sydney, where 2SER radio studios are housed, so probably somewhere down below us in this very building, who's come up with a very clever idea. If you get rid of the big tower that the wind turbine sits on and chuck it up in the air, you've got something which might be able to actually work a bit like a propeller. It's a bit like sort of a helicopter rotor. And so if you are able to design this in the right way, you might be able to use the fact that when the wind's blowing, it can keep the thing up in the air and generate electricity at the same time, which seems to me to be an incredibly clever idea. So he's come up with a design for an airborne wind turbine for generating electricity. And the idea is this. You've got several propeller-type turbines all attached to it to a large frame, and you need to put it up in the air where the wind's always going to be blowing. So you need to get it up to heights of tens of thousands of meters or tens of thousands of feet and up there in the jet stream where you've pretty much got wind blowing all the time. So these things sit up there at just the right angle so that as the wind's blowing through the rotors, they're acting like a helicopter propeller, keeping it up, giving it lift, but also churning away, turning around the turbine, and producing electricity. So now, can anyone spot the problem with this design?
Well, you'd want to hope that it worked pretty well, because otherwise I can imagine enormous great turbines plummeting out of the sky at random intervals.
Yeah.
Perhaps might not be the most popular.
That's got to be worse than bad TV reception.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so that's one obvious problem. Anyone else?
Where the aeroplane's going to go.
Where the aeroplane's going to go, that's a bit of a problem as well. You wouldn't want your 747 jetliner suddenly, bloody hell, wind turbine out of the way. But there is one other thing that I didn't mention, and that is that these things actually have to be tethered to the ground. You can't just put the turbine up there and go, oh, bye, turbine, we'll see you next time around. It's tethered there. It's got a big, bloody great cable connected to the ground. So these things are tethered, right, up there in the sky. Now, the designs that they've come up with, they're hoping to get ones which are in the order of, 20 megawatts, which is, a sizable amount of electricity, except if you want to do something like, power a city, in which case you need many of these things. So we're not talking about one of these helicopter devices up there in the air. We're talking about whole farms of them, tethered to the ground, up there in the jet stream, flying around. It's something a bit different. It's a new idea. It's a bold idea. But from the article that we found this story in, which was in Popular Science, the quote that I like is from the engineer, Brian Roberts, who says, "We've done all of the designs, the sizing, the weights, the costs. Now we just need $4 million to build the prototype." Now, $4 million is not a hell of a lot in the world of research, but we're still waiting for that first airborne wind power generating prototype. Could be a little bit before we have one of these tethered in our backyards.
Well, it sounds better than the airborne nuclear power plants the Americans play with.
well, true.
It's one of those crashes, yes. You're really in trouble.
Let's not. We'll maybe try that one in a future edition of Discovery.
Chencha, si yo nací con mi pata gamba. Váyanse pa'l diablo, partían sin vergüenzas, partía de canallas, no la hagan hablar. Váyanse pa'l diablo, partía sin vergüenzas, partía de canallas.
That's all from us here at Discovery for the week. If you'd like any information about the show, you can send us an email to discovery@2ser.com. Joining me in the studio were Adam Richardson, Matt Francis, and Chris Stewart. And today's show was produced by Matt Clark, with technical assistance by Jackie Peffer, in the studios of 2SER Sydney. We're also broadcast nationally via the Community Radio Network. I'm Noel Hanna, and I hope you tune in at the same time next week for another edition of Discovery. Váyanse pa'l diablo, partía sin vergüenzas, partía de canallas, no le hagan hablar. Camina como chencha, camina como chencha, pero camina como chencha, oye, camina como chencha. Trabajando allá en el Nacional, me han pasado por aquí un telón, y ahora todos quieren apostar que por aquí puede pasar un camión. Váyanse pa'l diablo, partía sin vergüenza, partía de canallas, no me hagan hablar. Váyanse pa'l diablo, partía de sinvergüenza, partía de canallas, no me hagan hablar. Ahí camina como chencha, la gamba. Oye, chencha, la gamba.